Frank, Diane, NLL, Paul, all with note. Anybody with any yeses? Do we have anybody with any real questions tonight? If not, well, I'll have to suggest the subject. I've got one. Give me your call letter name this time.
KC2SYS, Mike. I got a quick question.
KG2T, Joe. No question.
WECDL, I have a million questions, but it'll take too much time, so I'll hold off. Because every facet of ham radio is a question to me. Go ahead, Dick.
KG2QIQ with a question.
Good evening, KG2KY.
Okay, in reverse order, we've got Glenn, Andy with questions, Mike. Did Mike said no? Okay, we had another guy that said yes. Was it KC2FY something or other? Mike, did you say yes or no?
Yes, it's KC2SYS, and I have a question.
Okay, let's start off, and Mel recognized, of course. Mike, let's start off with you. KC2, Sierra Foxtrot Yankee, I think it is. You are number one on the runway. You got it, Mike.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Good evening to the net. I have a quick question regarding, I just purchased a Kenwood TS-530S. It's an older receiver. It's going to be my first one, and I was wondering if anybody knew anything about it. I bought it on eBay. I paid like $182.
Now, you call it a receiver. I think it's a transceiver. I think you got an oldie but goodie. I've got a TS-520 80-10-meter rig with a pair of 6146 in the final. I think it puts out a healthy 100 watts of a single sideband and all of the ham bands 80-10 meters. Guarantee Mel has more familiarity with that one. So tell us what you know about a TS-530S and tell us how good a deal he got for $180. I think he got a good deal, Mel. K2KEY. K2RIW the tech net.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Believe it or not, there's something marking out there today, and I don't know where it's coming from, but I hear it's the receiver. Hopefully, we're not going to get a power failure here. The 530F, yes, it was a popular radio. I guess it goes back to the 80s. And very nice transceiver, basic transceiver. But, yes, again, it's in working condition, good working order. I think it's got a fairly good deal. I know that, you know, the technology has moved on considerably. But for a person that's maybe starting out or first venture into ham radio, I don't think you've got too wrong if it's, like I say, in a decent shape.
Now, let me ask you this, Mel. In the case of the older rigs, and I think a 530 is one of these with a 6146 in the final, my belief is that's got a real tuning and loading control for the plate tank circuit. Therefore, you could say it has a manually operated, completely built-in antenna tuner with probably considerably more tuning range than the solid-state rigs that are more modern. In other words, a modern day rig, if you connect it to an antenna with more than about a 1.6 standing wave ratio, the transmitter will either trip down to a lower power or turn itself off entirely as a mode of self-protection. The slightly older rigs with a real tank circuit, high tank circuit, real tuning and loading control, like I think the 530 has, with a pair of 6146s, I suspect it's a lot more forgiving. I'll bet you that rig would tolerate, at most phase angles, a 2-to-1, 3-to-1 standing wave ratio and keep right on cranking, put out a nice clean signal. That's my belief. I wonder if you can confirm that, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. The right mix. Remember, the old radio basically had the tuner built into it, where if they have to pay for the same device, extra money for what you've got as part of the rig. Oh, no doubt the old radio, as long as you can get some kind of dip on the final, whatever way you manipulate it, the loading control is there. And dip, of course, low dip, and all, and so, got some kind of semblance of order there, you can tolerate no doubt what SWR many people travel running. We don't even know many of them did not have the instrument to measure. And the old joke was that they were loading up bed springs and window frames and things like that. You know, it's not far-fetched. I know a number of people that they said, well, this is the best they can get in the way of an antenna, and they gave it a try, and some way or another, they were getting out with it. But we also have to understand that possibility that the propagation was in their favor. So this was basically, you know, ham radio of 20-plus years ago, and I say more power to them, and continue, ham radio operators continue, you know, with a lot of both old and new equipment, and just get on the air with it. That's the bottom line, Dick, over.
J2IZ.
K2IZ. I'll give us your name, and if you got a comment on it, TS530, go right ahead.
Hey, good evening. His name is John. I'm in Colby. I've got a 530 sitting here, my feet wrapped up in plastic with a remote VFO sitting on the shelf behind me with a wire. I switched over to the 480 SAT about 2 years ago, and I was thinking about unloading the thing. I was sitting here listening to you guys. You got a couple minutes because I can fill you in pretty good on a 530, over.
We sure do, and I guarantee that Mike would like to hear about it. It is my belief that the 520-530 series had an extremely good noise blanker on the receiver for impulse noise. When you buy a rig like that, you think you're buying a transceiver. You're really buying two objects at once. You're buying the transceiver and an antenna tuner because they're both wrapped into the same package as they used to be in the old days. Nowadays, you have to make two separate purchases to get that. So you're getting a very good antenna tuner, a rather high dynamic range receiver, a fairly bulletproof receiver, a reasonably robust transmitter, a fairly large tuning range on what antenna standing wave ratio it'll tolerate, and as I said before, a good noise blanket. These are some of the things I know about the 520, and I think it's also true of the 530. Anything you can tell us, John, as to differences between 520, which is what I own, and 530, which is what Mike now owns, John has owned for some time. Tell us everything you know about it. Both the good and the bad. I think John would like to have the whole story. K2 India Zulu, K2RIW.
K2RIW. Why does that sound familiar? Dick Nadel, I know you.
Yep, I've been running the TechNet for 26 years, every Sunday night, 8 o'clock, for 26 years. There are some people who know me from that, John. Go ahead. And by the way, sounds like you and I maybe work together or we've met each other. You might tell us, you might tell me what your and my previous history is. Go ahead, John.
Probably back in the 70s, you were still at Tech. I was a section communications manager for New York City, Long Island. And I'm going on my 40th year with Verizon. Let me dump it back to you real quick, and then I'll go on about the 530, over.
Hey, you're living in Copenhagen now, and I know of another guy who used to live in Copenhagen. Can't even recall that it's right now, an old timer. Let me think now. I've never had a tech license. I went straight from novice to general. I'm licensed since 1956. So in 1956, I had a general class license. So where did you and I meet each other? And go on and tell us about the 530, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. It's probably Suffolk County Radio Club. And again, I was the section communications manager for the AWRL for 10 years. My old call is WBCHY, my next door neighbor, TV. We go from there. First of all, the 530 that I have is a very, very, very forgiving radio. I will say that in that when I first got on the air, I built a antenna. And it's just sitting under the desk and not being used. And I noticed that the radio over the time, it just never seemed to tune up right. And then when I hit the antenna, I had to retune it. Turns out that I basically had a open one side and one of the connectors inside the antenna. As soon as I hit it with the soldering iron, everything works great. drop it for a second. I used the 530 with a CW filter, and like I say, I ran a traffic test with it, ran a PSK with it. Like I say, it's a very, very forgiving radio. Unfortunately, little things here and there do break. There is an outstanding Yahoo group for the Kenwoods. And when mine did break, I sent it to a gentleman down in Florida, and I paid for the shipping, and he did it basically first-class outstanding job on everything. As to what the receiver does, it all depends upon your antenna. If you don't have a good antenna up there, yeah, you can have the best receiver in the world, and it's not going to work if the antenna does not work. Again, I ran it on PSK, CW, sideband, contest. The radio got a real good workout. I sent it down there, he said that everything was good. And I heard the comment about the, the tuning part. Like I say, I've got the 480 SAT. Let me drop it a second. I've got the 480 SAT. And one thing you guys got to realize is the internal tuner is not a miracle worker. I've also got an old Dentron super tuner sitting right next to it that I even used with the 530. Coming right out of the 530 with a 90-degree elbow connector into a low-pass filter, and then probably about a 2-foot coax jumper into the antenna switch. And that went, again, into the matcher, as they call it. We know it's not a matcher, but they call it a super tuner, so we'll leave it at that. With the 480, I use the internal tuner to touch up the beam. That's it. Anything else, I've got a dipole sitting out back. When you see the dipole, it's the strangest thing you ever go see in your life, but it works. I tune everything with the Dentron tuner and leave it at that. The only problem I have is on 40 meters, even with the tuner set at what it's supposed to be, I still have to touch it with the internal tuner on 480, 100 watts out. Dick, let me turn it over to you so far and see if the other guys got any questions over.
Okay. Do you have any complaints about the 530? Is there anything it does that you're not completely happy with, John? Go ahead.
Not a thing. Not a thing. Like I said, I bought that radio back in 83. I picked up the external VFO probably about 3 or 4 years ago. And I'm at the point right now, Dick, that I really cannot, I don't have the time, I don't have the tools or the wherewithal right now to do any kind of repair work on the radio. Again, the Yahoo group, they offer excellent worldwide suggestions if you have problems. Where to get parts, what to look for, all kinds of stuff over.
As you can see, Mike, there probably are collections of people. You know, there are people who just love Rolls-Royce cars. I guarantee there's a couple of websites where the Rolls-Royce people get together and compare notes. By the same token, when it comes to the older Kenwood rigs, 520, 530, 450, and so on, the Kenwood rigs, there are people who will gather and compare notes, tell each other what idiosyncrasies it has, how to make improvements if you want to, where to get the parts, who does the repairs. So you joined a good group, and you've got two objects, the antenna tuner and the transmitter, all for the price of one. And you're an excellent example of how a person can save an awful lot of money by buying older, known good rigs. The modern-day equivalent of that rig, it's got a couple of more horns and whistles. It probably has a tunable IF, and it's got more memories to it than the modern-day rig. But the modern-day rig with similar performance is probably around $1,500. Your $180 purchase is buying 90% of the same performance for 10% of the dollars, as you can tell. So it came out way ahead. Let's turn it over to you, Mike, in case you've got some questions for John. KC2 SFY, K2LIW in the tech net.
Hey, John, how are you? KC2 SYF. I spoke to you before. We're also members of the same club. I also have the AT230, which is a antennas from the Dutch Campbell takes, and I figured I'm probably going to get some newer equipment also, but this might be a piece of equipment that I bring out to field days or special events or something instead of bringing a $1,500 or $1,600 piece of equipment. But basically, you guys have been very, very helpful, and I do appreciate it. I hope that this antenna tuner that I have goes with that radio. Maybe somebody does know. And then, basically, you've answered most of my questions, and we can move on to the next person.
Yeah, what I've been saying, Mike, is that the large tuning and loading range that you have with that Kenwood 530 is the equivalent of an antenna tuner built in. And if you add an antenna tuner to the output of it, well, that'll give you a little bit more range, but you probably don't need it most of the time, unless you've got a pretty weird antenna. And the standing wave ratio of an antenna on HF frequencies is something that's highly misunderstood. The fact that a 1.6 or a 1.7 standing wave ratio on a modern-day solid-state rig will send it into the power decrease mode or the turn-off mode as a method of self-protection of the final stage. The fact that it's so persnickety leads people to believe that an antenna with greater than 1.7 standing wave ratio does not perform well. I personally have used antennas on the 20-meter band that had a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. As long as your tuning and loading controls or your antenna tuner, whichever you're using, has enough range to cover that situation, as long as you have a low enough loss in the feed line, that 20-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna that you think is terrible could be giving you 95% radiation efficiency of all the power you put into it. 95% of it's going into space in a predictable direction, and you're making QSOs with it. So standing wave ratio, highly misunderstood. Anyone with any further questions or comments on the 530, give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay. And you got our permission to come back in future weeks, Mike, as you learn the idiosyncrasies of the rig. There's a little bit of a learning curve to figure out how to do the tuning and loading and so on. There's probably a tune-up mode where you can cut back the drive in order to not be stressing the final tubes. Or some people do it by transmitting for a few seconds at a time, so that even if the final stage is mistuned, you're not overheating the tubes. When the tubes are not at resonance or drawing high current, you are creating quite a bit of extra plate dissipation. And if you did that key down for a long period of time, the plate of the tubes, the 6146s, would be glowing and possibly shortening their life. But by making brief transmissions until you get proper alignment, you can get around that. There's a learning curve. My guess is the manuals on the old rigs used to cover things like that pretty well. The next person who I think signed in with a real question was Andy. Choose any question you want, Andy. It's just Andy and Glenn in that order. And we got another 3 hours to go. So of the zillions of questions you've got, Andy, let's take question number one from A2CDL, the technical maven of Limark, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hi, I'm on a handheld because I'm in the middle of a project. Can you hear me okay, Dick?
Loud and clear. You sound good. Not to worry. As long as that battery holds up, you got it made.
You can thank him for fixing the repeater 2 weeks ago. Actually, it's not a question. I thought maybe you would talk about something that we spoke about a while back, and that was one of the topics regarding Bessel functions, how they work, where they're used, what their purpose is, and how an amateur can use this to measure his deviation if he has the right equipment. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that, because it's a very interesting subject.
Yeah, a little bit on the technical side. And by the way, a quick question for you is, the machine last week was very down in sensitivity. Was there some form of error going on with the low noise preamplifier on the repeater? Or was there something else creating desensitization of the receiver? You might give us a couple of words on that one, Andy.
It was mechanical.
So, looks like Eric fixed it. Eric, you said it was mechanical. In other words, there was some form of desensitization because of lack of shielding between transmitter and receiver. That was what you mean by mechanical?
No, I mean mechanical as in a lousy connection.
That particular repeater has a works in the drawer or in the tray, and as you open and close the tray, of course, the cables have to follow and it eventually rubs and twists and turns. And it's only a mono connector, and eventually it, the socket part of it gets a little wider for the center turn, so eventually you wind up with just a capacitor.
I see. And that can be very noisy. Okay. So Andy wants to know about Bessel function. And let's just talk about modulation in general. If I'm transmitting Morse code, and I press down the key and hold it, and if I look on a good spectrum analyzer that shows me every individual frequency that's coming out of that transmitter, I would see what looks like an oscilloscope screen, a square screen, where frequency is horizontal and amplitude is vertical, and you would see essentially one vertical line in the center of the screen. All your power is on one particular frequency. When you run key down, no modulation. Now, if it's an amplitude-modulated transmitter, and I whistle into the microphone with a 1 kilohertz note, something like that, that was only 600 hertz, but you know what I mean. On my spectrum analyzer, I would see the main line in the center, the carrier, 600 hertz or 1 kilohertz higher. I would see a second line to the right and a third line to the left, equal in amplitude, those two side lobes. And if I was 100% modulating, each of those side lobes would be 1/4 of the power of the main lobe, the center one. 6 dB down would be the upper side lobe and the lower side lobe. That's what 100% amplitude modulation looks like. And if I whistled into the microphone at amp volume, so I'm only 50% modulated instead of 100% modulated, that upper side lobe and lower side lobe would not be 6 decibels weaker than the carrier. They'd be 12 dB weaker. 50% modulation is half voltage of the modulating power. Half voltage is 1/4 the power, 1/4 the power, 6 dB down. And the side lobes start off 6 dB down when you're 100% modulated, and they go another 6, and it would be a total of 12 dB down. So amplitude modulation, you create one single upper side lobe, one single lower side lobe, separated from the carrier by the rate of the modulation, the tone. Obviously, human speech has got a whole lot of individual tones, and on the spectrum analyzer, it would be a more complicated curve. But for a simple tone of amplitude modulation, that's what you get. If I was using narrowband FM modulation, very narrowband FM modulation, it would almost look the same as the 50% modulated AM. There would be an upper side lobe and a lower side lobe, something like 12 decibels down. And if you had real good instrumentation, you could find out that the upper side lobe, lower side lobe, and carrier have a slightly different relationship in 90 degrees out of phase compared to the amplitude modulated situation. But with an ordinary spectrum analyzer, you wouldn't see that. If I had a very high dynamic range spectrum analyzer, even with narrowband FM, and I looked very carefully near the baseline, I would see the main side lobe, 1 kilohertz up and 1 kilohertz down, because I'm whistling into the microphone of this FM transmitter at a 1 kilohertz rate. But if I looked very carefully, 2 kilohertz above the carrier, I would see a weak side lobe, and 2 kilohertz below the carrier, I would see a weak side lobe. In the case of FM modulation, angular modulation, you always make a very large number of side lobes. For narrowband FM, the higher side lobes fall off very fast, but they're always there. So an FM signal, if you want to be really persnickety, you can say it's got an extremely broad bandwidth. Not quite true, because the amplitude of the side lobes fall off so fast that 99% of the energy for narrowband FM is really contained in the carrier and these two main upper and lower side lobes. And then the next side lobes get weaker and weaker. That's narrowband FM. But if you start transmitting louder and louder signals into the microphone, so to speak, then my narrowband FM becomes mediumband FM or wideband FM. And a good example of wideband FM is the kind of broadcast radio that you have between 88 and 108 megacycles. Those are wideband FM modulated signals, which are allowed as much as plus or minus 75 kilohertz of FM deviation. In other words, the peak of the sine wave coming out of the microphone, when the sine wave out of the microphone is positive, the frequency is going up as much as 75 kilohertz. During the time your negative portion of the sine wave coming out of the microphone, I'm whistling the microphone at a 1 kc rate. During the negative side lobe, I'm allowed to go as much as 75 kilohertz lower. Plus or minus 75 kilohertz implies that the signal is 150 kilohertz wide. Each individual channel for FM broadcast is assigned a channel 200 kilohertz wide. You could say there's a little bit of a guard band above and below the peak modulation. There's a little more to the story, but that's a rough way of looking at it. On a spectrum analyzer, you would see a large number of individual side lobes on that wideband FM transmitter. Every one of them is spaced 1 kilohertz, and you would see roughly 75 individual lines above and 75 individual lines below the center frequency when I whistle into that wideband FM transmitter by standard broadcast standards. All of those individual side lobes have they don't all have the same amplitude. They have very crazy looking amplitudes, but there is kind of a Marquette like spectrum coming out of an FM transmitter under the conditions which I just described. Now, in the case of going from narrowband FM to wideband FM, a tremendous number of things are happening. In the case of an amplitude modulated transmitter, which is plate modulated, high level modulated, you are really putting extra power into the transmitter when you modulate. You talk into the microphone, if it was a 1 kilowatt power transmitter, the amplitude modulator would have to have the ability to generate 500 watts of audio. In order to modulate the plate voltage on the final tube, it's high level modulation. And so when I whistle into the microphone at full amplitude on a 100% modulated, amplitude modulated transmitter, the carrier is always 1 kilowatt, doesn't change. Those two side lobes are going to be a quarter of a kilowatt each, the upper one and the lower one, a total of 500 watts. So during the time I'm amplitude modulating at full modulation, 100% capability of an AM 1 kilowatt transmitter, during that period of time, I am continuously putting 1,500 watts into that antenna. 500 watts is coming from the audio amplifier, 1,000 watts is coming from the carrier generator, you could say, and its power supply. That's the way AM works. In the case of FM, the power of the microphone is never more than milliwatts. It is moving the main frequency, the oscillator, that goes through the whole drive chain of the transmitter. You're moving the frequency, but you're not changing the power. A 1 kilowatt FM transmitter, whether it is key down, unmodulated, whether it is narrow band modulated with a 1 kc note, or whether it's modulated wide band, plus or minus 75 kilohertz, FM broadcast standards, in all cases, the transmitter power output stays the same, 1 kilowatt. Well, there's conservation of energy going on here. Where's all that power coming from? The answer is it's coming from the carrier. So when you create those side lobes in an angular modulated transmitter, an FM transmitter, you're sucking power out of the carrier and putting it into those side lobes. You didn't realize you're doing that. From your point of view, you're sending voltage into a varactor diode. That might be a way of building the voltage-controlled oscillator. You're putting a variable audio voltage into the varactor diode. As the voltage goes up and down, the capacitance goes down and up, and the therefore the resonant frequency of the oscillator. The resonant frequency of the oscillator goes up and down, and therefore my frequency is being modulated. Now, Bessel functions are a not easy to understand branch of mathematics. A little bit more difficult to understand than logarithms. a hell of a lot more difficult to understand than add, subtract, multiply, and divide. Logarithms are a kind of mathematics that some people have a little bit of trouble with unless they spend some time studying it. And you go into the good books on Bessel functions, or you use your Wikipedia, use your website to search down FM modulation and Bessel functions and the relationship between the two, you'll find out that this branch of mathematics describes how much power goes into each one of those side lobes, how much power is left in the carrier or sucked out from the carrier. If you go to a good book like the Reference Data for Radio Engineers, and you look at the page on Bessel functions, and there's something in there called modulation index. In other words, if I decide how much my frequency is going up and down of the carrier when I FM modulate, and at what rate I'm doing that, I divide one by the other, and it's called modulation index. I'll give you an example. Let me drop. If I was whistling with a 1 kilohertz note, and I adjusted the amplitude of this FM transmitter, audio microphone, so that I'm deviating plus and minus 1 kilohertz in frequency. 1 kilohertz of deviation at a rate of 1 kilohertz, I'd be dividing 1 kilohertz by 1 kilohertz. The answer would be 1. That's an example of a modulation index of 1. Let me make the audio a little bit louder. I turn up the gain on the microphone, and now I'm deviating plus or minus 2.4 kilohertz at a 1 kilohertz rate. I take the deviation, I put that as the top number. The rate, I put that as the bottom number. My rate is 1 kilohertz. My deviation, the top number, is 2.4. That's a modulation index of 2.4. Why did I choose that number? I may have it a little bit wrong, but I think 2.4 is the first carrier null. You go to the graphs that you can find in Reference Data for Radio Engineers or any other book that will tell you either the tabulation or the graphs of Bessel functions. The horizontal axis is always called modulation index. The vertical axis is really amplitude of that particular side lobe. And you'll see a bunch of curves on that page. One is the J0 curve. That really means J, for some crazy reason, they use J to represent amplitude of the side lobe and carrier in a Bessel function. So J represents carrier amplitude. The Y1, the J1 is the first side lobe, the J2 is the second side lobe, and so on. You'll see these curves wiggle across that page on that graph, and you'll notice that the carrier curve is up at the 100% point when the modulation index is zero. In other words, when you have no FM modulation, like a Morse code key down transmitter, no modulation of any kind, you could call that unmodulated FM, unmodulated AM, unmodulated period. Your J0 term on that Bessel curve will be at the 100% point. All the power is in the carrier, no power is in the side lobe. You start cranking up the amplitude of that 1 KC audio coming out of the microphone, and you'll notice that the curves on that Bessel function graph are telling you that the carrier is getting weaker and the side lobes are getting stronger. And it's by cause of conservation of energy. Let me drop. Energy is coming out of the carrier and going into the side lobe as you FM modulate. Why that happens, a little bit complicated. Bessel function tells you the exact magnitude, doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling for why it does that. Take my word for it. As you're deviating the frequency up and down at just the right amplitude, at just the right rate, you could say you're transmitting an in-phase carrier half the time and an out-of-phase carrier half the time. Therefore, the time average magnitude of the carrier is zero. A modulation index of roughly 2.4 is where the carrier goes to zero and all your power is in those first few side lobes. That's the first carrier null position on Bessel function. Knowing that ahead of time from the curves or studying the mathematics, you can now adjust amplitude of modulation very accurately if you wanted to. You now have a very specific datum point, so to speak, on that spectrum analyzer or on that oscilloscope that's looking at carrier power. You adjust the amplitude of the microphone, the gain control of the microphone up and down, as you connect your audio oscillator or you whistle into the microphone, and you go up and down until the first carrion null occurs, you have just identified the 2.4 modulation index. You now know that if you're doing it at a 1 kilohertz rate, oscillator frequency you're putting into the microphone, and if that carrier went to zero, you now know that your plus and minus deviation is exactly 2.4 kilohertz up, 2.4 kilohertz down. In F, by the way, I'm rounding off something that's really 2.4 like that. But it's 2.4, you can look it up. But you've now got an exact calibration point. What was the exact number?
2.4048. Now, if you want to do it for 5 kilohertz, you would, for the first cell phone function, you would need 207.17 hertz as your input.
So, as you can see, either adjust the amplitude or the frequency, and you can get that first carrier null very precisely. You've now got a data point. In other words, in order to figure out whether or not you're over-modulating or under-modulating on an FM transmitter, for a person who's a little bit naive, finding out is he over or under modulating, violating FCC rules, or using the right amount of amplitude that will fill up the guy's handy talking receiver with nice clean audio without banging into the sides of the IF strip and making distortion, or without having the audio so low like I've got right now, you almost can't hear. I mean, transmitting audio that's too low, a lot of people are not going to hear you, particularly in a noisy car. Transmitting audio that's too loud, sound very distorted. You don't want to do that. There's an exact amount of modulation that's most desirable for each one of the services. Knowing that amount of modulation that's most desirable forces you to be able to measure what is your deviation. Well, depending on the calibration of my particular receiver and the FM discriminator that's in it, I can easily come to the wrong conclusion. I can easily over-modulate or under-modulate if I don't have a receiver that's traceable to the bureau. Or if I've got a service monitor, like an IFR, that's well calibrated, fantastic. Now that you know exactly what the deviation is, you now can calibrate everything. I wonder if that helps a little bit, though. This is the beginning of Bessel function, the beginning of angular modulation understanding, a little bit of understanding of the FM modulation we're all using when we talk to these repeaters. I probably have created some questions. Let me send it over to Andy first, then I'm going to send it over to the crowd, anybody who asks their questions or adds their comments to what I've said so far. It's A2CDL, who asked a damn good question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KYL, make some comments too.
You're on the list. Go ahead, Frank. Andy first.
Okay, Dick. Very good. Well, see, I saved a good one for last. Okay, I could just sum up what you said because it's I understand the mathematics involved because I've seen the pages out of the manual on my spectrum analyzer that I own, and they do give you Bessel function curves, and if you look at the curves, if you just glance at them, you can get very confused because there's so many curves on top of curves. You really have to study it to figure out where each null is going to be given per frequency that you're modulating. So, it's, like you said, I'm just going to summarize, it's a very good thing to know because you can easily, with a spectrum analyzer, adjust your deviations. You'll know exactly what your deviation would be if you don't have any other equipment. To understand why there's a null in the carrier and to see that is, and you can say it is a little bit confusing because there is always a carrier. And it's just the mathematical function of what you see. So, I guess you'll just cast it around because other people say more things about it. Incidentally, in microwaves, when I was aligning a microwave system, we used a deviation calibrator, which actually used the Bessel function theorem to adjust the deviation of the modulated signal on the channel modules that were modulating the microwave system. This is a 6 gig microwave system that had something like 600 plus channels to it, used for multiplexing over one microwave link. and there is a deviation caliber, which, or calibrator, I'm saying caliber, calibrator which is used to adjust the deviation of each channel module, and actually this is made by Motorola, this piece of equipment. Just thought I'd mention that. Dick, thanks. I'll be listening. Back to you, WHCDS.
Okay, good. Eric,
recognize.
Eric, you want to add something to what Andy just said? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of let the folks who don't really understand. But the Bessel function really is it's a complex differential equation. But essentially, you can break it down as to a function that works in circles, okay? Some people will call them cylinder functions or cylindrical harmonics, right? And you can find solutions to it in Laplace and I think also Helmholtz. But the point of the matter is that every RF radio wave is really, in essence, a circle, even if it's from 30 to 60 degrees, which is back to zero again. So doing differential equations in the circle is what makes it so rather difficult, but once you understand differential equations, it becomes a lot easier, actually.
Okay. There's a number of ways of trying to get a handle on what a Bessel function is. The person hit with it the first time will say, wow, why do I have to learn that? What's the useful application of this? And FM modulation and a number of other kinds of angular functions, things that go in circles, are definitely helped by Bessel functions. And to try to understand the Bessel functions themselves, there's two or three ways of doing it. Eric has given you one of them. One of the things that Andy just said is that there's always a carrier. Not necessarily. In the case of FM, where the total transmitter power is never changing in theory. If I've got a 1 kilowatt transmitter, and whether I do or don't FM modulate it, then it's always going to put out exactly 1 kilowatt if it's operating correctly. At certain amounts of deviation, 2.4 and 5.3 or something like that, are the first two nulls. In other words, at that specific amount of FM deviation, that so-called modulation index, the carrier does go to zero. All the power that used to be in the carrier is now placed into the side load. You could say the carrier is spending half of its time in phase, half of its time out of phase, and it adds up to zero average carrier power on a good spectrum analyzer. So there are places where the carrier disappears, but you have the equivalent of a carrier as far as the total power in the side load. And you can draw a vertical line across that graph of Bessel function. And that one vertical line, like say the 2.4 modulation index point, a little bit off to the left-hand side is the origin, you move the 2.4 lines to the right, you draw on a vertical line, you've calculated or you've measured on that graph the amount of J0, J1, J2, J3. J0 is the amount of carrier power. J1 is the amount of side load number one power. J2 is the second side load power, 2KC away from the carrier, and so on, 2KC away from where the carrier would be. You add up all of those powers, and by the way, the Bessel functions are in the function of voltage. Be careful, those curves are not plotting power, they're plotting voltage. But you take each one of those voltage coefficients off that graph, square them, add them all together, you'll always come back to unity. That's your original kilowatt of power. So for every modulation index, when you add up all the power of carrier plus all the side lobes, and know also that there's an upper side lobe and a lower side lobe, and the graph is only telling you one of them at a time. So you add it all together and you always come up with unity power. So it gives you a little bit more feeling for where do the side lobes come from. Are they violating conservation of energy? No, they're not. And there are specific modulation indexes where the carrier goes to zero and they become extremely convenient calibration points. And you can literally take your $10,000 IFR service monitor and by way of the Bessel function use of its spectrum analyzer, you can literally check the calibration of your service monitor that you just paid $1 zillion to have it made traceable to the Bureau at some factory somewhere. You can double check if the guy did it right, if you know what I mean. Mel has been working with Bessel Function and FM Modulation for some time. He's going to add a few words. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, let me see if I can simplify it down a little bit, because the guy's been in a little deep, and I know I'm going to get emailed on it. I have tried to explain it to people a little bit simpler. Let's take this Bessel, first of all, he came up with this mathematical formula, and he found that the, or what he called the first modulation index, or null, was 2.405. That's the exact mathematical equation. And he called that, at that point, the first carrier null. Now, you'll find on many of the service monitors, they have both two things. You'll have a deviation meter and a spectral display. So, by applying this, well, let's take, for instance, we had a deviation of 5 kilohertz. We can now use an audio tone of 5,000 divided by the null that we just said, 2.405, or so we get 2079 hertz. That's the tone. So we can automatically observe the spectrum and see that the 5,000 deviation is actually at 2.2079 hertz. So in other words, it's just giving us a reference. So what happens is now the first null, I can say 2.405, and then the second one will come at 5.52. This is the simplest way I can think of explaining it without any going any further to further FM deviation. But I can take the next step, but I think you better let it at this point without making it over.
WS2N?
Major. Paul and Eric, in that order. One of the things that we're not making clear here is that we can talk about the amount of deviation that the carrier is moving up and down in frequency as you talk into the microphone. That's deviation, magnitude of FM. We can also talk about the rate. Am I putting a high-frequency tone or a low-frequency tone into the microphone, or whistling at a high note or a low note? When I take the deviation as the number on top and the rate as the number on the bottom and do that division, that's called modulation index. So therefore, the first null of the carrier is a modulation index on the Bessel function, 2.405. I can get to a 2.405 modulation index by a zillion different ways. I can make the deviation go up and down. I can make the tone or the rate go up and down. If I make the ratio of the two 2.4, I will have a carrier null. So when it comes to my calibration, I can either adjust the deviation knob or the tone frequency knob, get that null, then measure that tone frequency on a frequency counter, and I've now got a way of calibrating the whole system. So once you know it's modulation index, delta F over F sub M, as they call it. In other words, how much am I deviating? That's the number on top. What's the rate at which I'm doing it? They call it F sub M, frequency of modulation. The number of the denominator, divide one into the other, modulation index, and that horizontal axis of all those Bessel curves is modulation index. Paul, WS2N first, K2LIW, you got a Paul.
Okay, the only reference that I found to FW Bessel in the ARR handbook, well, I have a couple of books here, but this one's 1991. They do have it on 9-4. They show graphs, but they show eight different sidebands that they're using on the graph, and then they show the carrier, but then they show the carrier completely disappearing at, like you said, the 2.405, and then they have 5.52 and 8.654. They show that on the graph, you know, as the carrier keeps down and on amplitude and then back up. and then down one more time and back up again. It's noted that it completely disappears at those three locations that the modulation is at. So that's really all they have on the vessel functions here. They don't need too much mass affecting them.
No, I'm sure they wouldn't include the mass. When you actually see the vessel function written out mathematically, and I've once programmed a calculator to do that, and it's an inexact equation. In other words, it's one of these infinite series type equations. And I've written a program which carries out the first 10 or so terms, which was close enough for the particular function I was doing at the time. It's not an easy one to program, but once you do program it, you get some answers that are good to five or six decimal places. All of the really good math books I could get a hold of only gave vessel functions down to about three decimal places. The particular project I was on, I had to know the fourth and fifth decimal place, so I had to do my own programming to do that. Know that the vessel function has its first null at 2.4, roughly, second null at 5.5, the third null at 8.6, and there's a zillion more of them. Now, remember before I told you that first null is where you can say the carrier term is spending half of its time in phase as you deviate up in frequency and half of its time out of phase as you deviate down in frequency. And that's the one place where it comes out zero, an equal amount of time up and down in deviation as far as the carrier is concerned, in phase and out of phase. In between 0 and 2.4 modulation index, you could say the carrier is completely in phase. In phase dominates over the out of phase. Between 2.4 and 5.5, the carrier is now coming back in amplitude, but it's 180 degrees out of phase. It is spending more time out of phase than in phase. The vessel curve tells you that because the J0 term, the carrier term, you see it go through the horizontal axis and go negative. And it goes negative between 2.4 and 5.5. Between 5.5 and 8.6, it's positive again. So you're sucking power out of the carrier, and you're doing other things to the carrier when you FM modulate. You can see that FM modulation, mathematically speaking, is complicated. When I think it was Mr. Armstrong first proposed using FM modulation in the 30s, and let me drop. The mathematicians at that time said, hey, that method of modulation is going to make an infinite number of side lobes. It'll never work. You're wasting your time. He was told that many times. He built this great big structure in New Jersey, this great big carrier with the arms off to the side. That's where FM broadcast first took place, if I've got the story straight. People listened to the hi-fi music over his FM broadcast station and said, boy, that sounds beautiful. How can something that's not supposed to work, the mathematicians say can't possibly work, how come the sound coming out of my loudspeaker sounds so beautiful? FM stands for fine music, is what people used to say in those days. Well, he soon realized that, yes, there's an infinite number of side lobes, but for any reasonable amount of modulation index, any reasonable amount of FM deviation, the number of side lobes is a fairly small number, easily contained within the IF strip of a well-tuned a well-designed receiver, and then so the system works like a charm, even though the mathematician said you can't possibly do that. K2EJ, K-E-2-E-J, K2LIW, you got it, Eric.
All right, Dick. And the only point that I mean, you pretty much covered everything, but the only thing that I wanted to point out is that in the process of thinking about this, you actually started out with a fixed value in terms of what you wanted to, if anything else, is where you have variables that you can plug in. And for example, the modulation index can be found right by dividing the maximum frequency deviation. In our case, we were talking about 5 kilohertz, so there's your 5 kilohertz. And then it's divided by the frequency that you want to modulate with. If you were going to do 1 kilohertz to get your 2.4, there you go. It's really broken down into a simple sense to people. And then to find the frequency of the null, it's simply the maximum frequency deviation divided by the modulation index. And you have that ratio once it's set up and going where you want. Possibly, it can be visualized in FM transmitted in terms of power. If you have a pipe that's two sides of 75 kilohertz wide, and you have a kilowatt of energy, and you can put it anywhere in that bandwidth of that pipe, and you still got a kilowatt of energy. So even though the carrier, or what we call the carrier, which is really the unmodulated signal, this place where it rests, it moves. It's sort of like if you were to take a microphone diaphragm and hook it up to a pot that varies the frequency of the transmitter. As you spoke into it, it changed the frequency of the transmitter. But I guess you covered all of that. KTRIWK,
good one. I got a question for Erica, Nick.
Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, Erica, I'm thinking regarding television standards. From what I understand, NTSC, the standard that's in use now, the deviation, the maximum deviation of it as far as the FM is concerned on the audio.
All right, then. Two different things. First of all, let's not talk about digital just yet. All right, let's talk about regular broadcast television. It's plus and minus 25 kilohertz, whereas FM is plus and minus 75 kilohertz. That's mono. M-O-N-O, mono signal. Okay, in television, we not only have the plus and minus 25 kilohertz, we have an additional plus and minus 5 kilohertz for something that's called stereo, or VTSC, which is actually a form of DBX compression plus an additional carrier, which then now makes your modulation a lot wider. Then we also have something called SAP, which is a separate audio program. That's 5 kilohertz. Actually, the stereo, I think I said, was 5. It's not 5. It's, I think, 7.5. And then we also have something called Pro Channel, which gets you to a total deviation of about 70 kilohertz on an FM audio transmitter. FM stereo for your FM dial is, you know, I don't remember exactly, it's 75 plus 15, I think. 15 or no, 19. So, you know, when we talk about those numbers are mono, no subcarriers, no nothing. Now, when we get to digital television, there is no FM, there is no subcarrier, there is no audio, there's just digits. There's no video, it's just digits. It's only later on that we turn it back into sound. And in the digital domain, by the way, we use Dolby HD3, which is, let me write it up, which is psychoacoustical compression, which is, to make a long story short, a kind of compression that makes sort of smart decisions. For example, if you're listening to a loud orchestra and they're really playing it up, and the guy in the back is holding a little triangle, he's going tink, tink, tink. Well, the AC3 says, you can't hear it, I don't need it, therefore I won't transmit it. So it's got that kind of, this is exactly the same form of audio. That form of audio actually even it organizes the same group of packets as it is on the DVD. It's exactly the same. So, and depending upon the broadcaster, they could make it so that it's super wide bandwidth or very narrow bandwidth, but most of us use 128 kilobits, which is pretty darn good. On DVDs, you're usually finding 384 kilobits, as opposed to a straight PCM, which is a meg and a half, which is the number of bits that it would take up to if you weren't using a compressor. Back to you, Andy, and back to Dick.
Yeah, I've got a question for you. Wouldn't a serious audiophile know that your compression technique took out that symbol, that tink tink in the background? Wouldn't he say that that's missing, therefore I don't like the compression technique, it's not really reproducing that audio, that orchestra with high fidelity? Wouldn't he make that complaint? Or did I misunderstand you on that one, Eric? Oh,
no, they have that complaint, and they continue to make that complaint with that type of compression, which is why with when the DVDs first came out, they came out with something called SACD, which is using one